Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The Civil War ripped the country apart in ways that still resonate with millions of Americans today. How did the Confederate Army justify its cause? One major answer to that question can be found in the pages of the Holy Bible. Ministers, chaplains who enlisted in the CSA, and military officers alike preached the gospel as though it had been written by Davis Lee Beauregard and Forrest instead of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But what sort of interpretation of the scriptures sustained the rebels through the agonies of privation and peril? Two MTSU alumni, Tracy Nichols Belt and her husband, Gordon T. Belt, examined this question in Onward Southern Soldiers, Religion and the Army of Tennessee in the Civil War, published by History Press. We'll talk with the Belts after a blue and gray review from MTSUnews.com.
Here are a few of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. Dr. Robert Bud Fisher has accepted the deanship of the MTSU College of Basic and Applied Sciences effective August 1st. Fisher joins MTSU from the University of Alabama at Birmingham, where he's professor of biology and has served as biology department chair since 2008. Before coming to UAB, Fisher was a faculty member and associate chair in the biology sciences department at Eastern Illinois University. His research areas include aquatic biology, fisheries biology, evolutionary biology, and physiological ecology. And MTSU's Dr. Cindy Smith Walters has been recognized as one of the National Project Learning Tree's top five outstanding educators. Smith Walters is a biology professor and co-director of MTSU's Center for Environmental Education. For MTSU News anytime, go to MTSUnews.com.
Tracy, Gordon, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
We'll start out with a little bit of background on the two of you. Both of you got your master's degrees at MTSU, and both in history. And Gordon, you have a minor in political science from UTC. And Tracy, you got your baccalaureate at Anderson University, is
yes.
that right?
Yes, mm-hmm.
And you are an ordained minister.
Yes, and also have a minor in political science.
Oh, at the okay. time, so, yeah. So you all know whereof you speak on many dimensions with regard to this particular subject. How did promoters of the Southern cause integrate biblical messages into their philosophy behind their fight to establish a separate nation? We'll start with Tracy.
Well, I think that you have to go back several decades. And actually, the church was debating and dividing over the issues that later divided the nation decades before the nation actually divided. And when you look back in the 1840s, you see the major denominations, the Baptists, the Methodists, and the Presbyterians, splitting from their northern counterparts and establishing separate churches within the South. This is where the Southern Baptists come from. And they're splitting over slavery, over the same issues that would later tear the nation apart. And, you know, at the time, you have great political thinkers like Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun who see this happening and who basically say, if the churches cannot be held together, there's no hope for the nation. And so what you have, and the reason that they see this and say this is because the church at the time spoke to pretty much every aspect of Southern life. And so when you look at culture in general and all of the different aspects of life, be it the role of women, the role of men, the role of the clergy, the role of government, you know, all of these things were answered by religion. So when religion took a stand, whether it was a self-defense stand or a stand on slavery, it was something that affected the entire area, the entire nation. And so you really had a launching point to then have the discussions that later went nationally.
There was an interesting analogy with regard to some comparisons of Southerners with the Israelites.
At the time, the religion practice was very Old Testament. You know, and when you think about, you know, I often say it far more resembled an Old Testament warrior than a New Testament disciple, even though the New Testament was used. When you look at reasons for war, reasons for even battle being so horrible and having to go through so many trials and things, you constantly had comparisons with the Old Testament, in particular Moses. Moses and the ancient Israelites are called upon a lot with ministers. David, the comparison of David and Goliath is used very frequently, and it's in a lot of the letters and diaries of the common soldiers, this comparison of David and Goliath. But they really focused on the Old Testament, which of course gives you that leadership who can be a military leader and a leader in the ministry at the same time. You have a whole different feel by looking at that.
How did they rationalize that the war was a defensive war, that they were being attacked, when in fact they fired the first salvo, verbally at any rate, by seceding from the Union?
First of all, you have a sort of a constitutional argument, and there certainly was a belief in the South that you had the right to leave. And ministers like Bishop Stephen Elliott, who is a bishop, senior bishop of the Confederacy, would say that just, you know, briefly or approximately 80 years prior, that these states had been sovereign states and had given up their sovereignty willingly to join the Union. And they never would have done that had they not believed they could leave. But then one of the interesting things is you have them fire at Fort Sumter, and you would think, well, that's aggression. But to many Southerners, they don't even see that as aggression, because at that point, they have stepped out, they've set up their own country, their own government, something they believe they can constitutionally do, and they're simply sending people home that they believe shouldn't be there. But from the North's perspective, of course, the flag has been fired upon. This is an act of war. And so at that point, when Abraham Lincoln calls for troops to come into this to the South, you have states, in particular like Tennessee, that's not yet left the Union, that see troops crossing the border. And that's what sets up in their mind this idea that this is a self-defensive war. This is a war where we have to stand up and fight for our homes and for our families. And this part comes into it be very religious, because from a religious standpoint, self-defense is always a reason to fight. And it's always a reason that you can expect God to be on your side and God to help you.
Since you referred to Bishop Stephen Elliott, senior bishop of the Confederacy, I'll read a quote from him just to indicate what kind of passionate prose we're talking about here.
Fire eater.
If this were a mere struggle for political power, a question of sovereignty and of dominion, then should I be loath to mingle the Church of Christ with it in any form or manner? But such is not the nature of this conflict. It is no such war as nations wage against each other for a balance of power or for the adjustment of a boundary. We are resisting a crusade of license against law, of infidelity against the altars of the living God, of fanaticism against a great spiritual trust committed to our care. We are warring with hordes of unprincipled foreigners, ignorant and brutal men, who, having cast off at home all the restraints of order and of belief, have signalized their march over our devoted country by burning the churches of Christ, by defiling the altars upon which the sacrifice of the death of our Savior is commemorated, by violating our women, by raising the banner of servile insurrection, by fanning into fury the demoniac passions of the ignorant and the vile. Sort of gives hyperbole a whole new meaning, doesn't it?
You know, it's interesting that you chose that, because I read that quote almost everywhere I go, because he really is telling you what the clergy's position was. He's not alone in that stand. He is certainly an ardent fire eater and very passionate, but this is the language coming down from the pulpit at the time. This is what the churches were preaching. And again, you know, this is why I say far more Old Testament than sort of that New Testament disciple of love and meekness. You know, you have that fiery, you know, reason to go out there and fight these hordes of unprincipled foreigners. And it really speaks to, you know, when you have in the Bible ancient Israel and the pagan countries around them. That's really the picture they're setting up, is that here is the South, and we're surrounded by these hordes of unprincipled foreigners. And so there is this religious duty to fight them.
We'll be back with more MTSU on the Record right after this.
The Middle East-centered MTSU seeks to promote greater understanding of the politics, history, and culture of this vitally important region of the world. Its mission includes the promotion of outreach programs and faculty research. The center sponsors lectures by Middle East experts and scholarly exchanges. We're especially pleased to offer a new interdisciplinary minor in Middle East Studies with courses in Arabic and Hebrew. This is Dr. Alan Hibbard, Center Director.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking about the book Onward Southern Soldiers by Tracy Nichols Belt and her husband Gordon T. Belt. Gordon, since you helped to dig up much of the material that went into this book from various sources, I'm going to let you talk a little bit now about how you found the writings of these various ministers, army chaplains, and foot soldiers, everyday grunts up on the front line, and also where you found some of the photographs in the book, because the photographs are really striking, too.
Well, thank you. I have a fortunate opportunity to work with a lot of archival colleagues in the state of Tennessee. I'm president of the Society of Tennessee Archivists. And so when we decided to pursue this research project in book form, our publisher said, well, we need some images. You have a great scholarship here, but we would like to have some images. We would like to have examples from different archives. And so what I was able to do is connect with some folks in the archival community, specifically the Tennessee State Library and Archives. They have an enormous collection of photographs and letters and memoirs from the common soldier. When it came to finding information about the clergy, the University of South in Sewanee was very helpful, particularly with the Episcopal Church records. And
because Leonidas Polk was one of the primary figures in this book about the melding of religion and the Confederacy.
Precisely, yes. And so that resource was enormously helpful to us in telling the story. The Civil War, in many ways, was the first war that was really documented on a mass scale by photography. And so we have a really unique picture of what the war was like, not only in the letters that clearly tell where they stood, but also the images. And so those images help present the story of Onward Southern Soldiers in greater detail.
And we're not talking about, you know, Matthew Perry daguerreotypes. We're talking mm-hmm. about actual portraits of them as youths and also up into their later years mm-hmm. around either the beginning or just after the start of the 20th century.
Absolutely. One of the pictures, actually two of the pictures in the book that were really one of our favorites is Henry Daniel Polk Hogan. He was a chaplain in the Army of Tennessee. And we were able to find an image of him and tell his story through his great-granddaughter.
Granddaughter.
Yeah, oh, his granddaughter.
Just his granddaughter, yes.
Wow.
And she's in Kansas.
She lives in Kansas.
How old is she?
You know, I'm not sure on her exact age, although she's definitely getting up in years. But she is his granddaughter. She was the youngest of his children. He had five or six children, and she was the youngest. But she had his papers and memoirs and some pictures of him. And so that's something that has been really fun, getting to talk with them and get some personal stories about them and then get these photographs.
That's extraordinary.
There's a photograph in the book where Hogan is at a reunion, and you see his regimental flag there, and he's just in full reunion regalia, and it's just really
89 years old.
Yeah, and it's really, really compelling. And to go along with the narrative that his granddaughter provided us, we actually found them through the Stones River battlefield. They had photocopies of a lot of material related to Hogan's service, and we were able to track down the relatives through Stones River.
There are several instances in the book where you talk about or quote ministers or chaplains who are saying, in essence, that we thought that we won this battle.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was God working through us. God wins this battle. We should not give ourselves the glory. We have to give all the glory to God.
Absolutely. And, you know, Reverend R.F. Bunting, who's chaplain to the 8th Texas Cavalry, really believes Manassas is the most dangerous battle of all for the South because he believes it created such a confidence in their own abilities that they forgot God, and that is seen as the most dangerous sin of all. And of course, sin is the big thing that they believe is causing defeats anyway, and the most dangerous sin is to take glory from God and place it on men. And so oftentimes defeats are viewed as the horror and the trials that you're going through actually create within a person a humility. You know, suffering drives you to your knees is the belief. And then once you are driven to your knees, you can finally acknowledge God as your only source for victory. And at that moment, then God will come back and bring peace to you and lift you up and bring you victory. So it you see throughout the war, trials are being made to try the soul, not just to win a victory, because it's really irrelevant if the cause is righteous, if the soldiers are not righteous. And so there is this belief that you need you know, to do that. And that's very Old Testament. And again, very Moses oriented. You know, when you look at Moses in the desert for 40 years, the people of Israel were being tried severely with disease, with war, with pestilence, but God was making them and preparing them for the nation they were to be. And so it's the same thing, that God is preparing the South for the nation he wants them to be, and these trials are necessary.
It's all part of God's plan.
Right.
And so if they lost a battle, then was it because they did not try hard enough, or they did not believe hard enough in God, conversely?
Most of the time it was because of sin. And there was sin comes in many forms. You know, most of the time these soldiers are being blamed for the fact that they swear, and they break the Sabbath, and they play cards. And, you know, I have Joseph Anderson Rogers in the book, who is the hospital steward in General Polk's Corps. And in 1864, he sums up what he believes is the woeful state of the Army of Tennessee by saying, most of the soldiers have testaments and packs of cards in their pockets. You know, so there is a belief that you're not really submitting to God in that sin. You know, or you could have the sin of being overconfident and placing, you know, or idolizing people like Stonewall Jackson and thinking that's where your victory. But most of the time it's because you're not recognizing God and you're having sin in the camp, and that God can't fully bless you because you're not really following him. And he's trying to make that character and build that character within you.
And well, that is the nature of war, that these things happen, that soldiers do these things to relieve tension during the course of a very tense endeavor. You reference several people in the book who make mention of the dichotomy of trying to pursue this righteous cause while they're gambling and swearing and womanizing and drinking.
Right. You know, and you can see that, and certainly among soldiers, they're far more religious right before a battle and right after a battle than they are in winter camp. You know,
yeah.
So, you know, that kind of changes. But to the ministry, they see this as being something that can destroy the cause. They believe, and at the end of the war, there is still this belief that sin, not the Northern Army, sin destroyed the heart of the cause. You know, and they always feel defeats aren't really that important, because when you're looking to God, the Almighty God, to save you, you know that he can come in at any time and save you with one great victory. So you just have to work at becoming the army you should be, and then God will take care of the rest.
We'll take another quick break, and we'll be back with more MTSU on the Record right after this.
Specialized training in forensic science prepares tomorrow's professionals through the Forensic Institute for Research and Education, or FIRE. The Forensic Anthropology Search and Recovery Team assists law enforcement with skeletal remains at crime scenes. Legendary forensic scientists provide lectures free to the public, and high school students work realistic crime scenes each summer at our CSI MTSU camp. I'm Dr. Hugh Berryman, Director of FIRE.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with the authors of Onward Southern Soldiers, Religion and the Army of Tennessee in the Civil War, published by History Press. Tracy Nichols Belt and Gordon T. Belt are both MTSU alumni. You referenced the Old Testament tinge to all of the rhetoric. So that's why we don't hear very much, blessed are the peacemakers and do unto others as you would have them do unto you, in the midst of all of this sermonizing.
Right. Most of the references connect with the Old Testament. Now, there's certainly people who follow, they're Christians and they're looking to Jesus for salvation and for help. But most of the references, and when you look at the Old Testament, I mean, it's made up of battles. I mean, it is, you know, it is a book that has a great number of battles in it, and you have a nation being created through much of it, and a nation trying to sustain itself. So there's an easier connection.
There's also a lot of revenge in the Old Testament. You get me, I'll get you back.
There is, you know, and I mean, and you have these scriptures of justification, that if somebody's coming after you, you have a right to self-defense. You have a right to stand up. So, you know, the New Testament really is not talked about as much, unless you're talking about slavery. And when you talk about slavery, then both the Old and the New Testament come into those arguments, and those are arguments that the church dealt with, like I said earlier, for decades. But when you're not speaking specifically of slavery, when you're looking at war itself, the connection's far more Old Testament.
How did they justify slavery as part of the overall holy cause of the Confederacy?
Because they believed they were bringing Christianity to a race that would not have it otherwise. That's the main
that
argument.
They were heathens from Africa, yes, and they needed to be brought to Jesus.
Right. And they would look to the Old Testament. First of all, you know, when you go through the Old Testament, they're slave societies. The great patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were slave owners. When you look at the New Testament, they're slave societies. And they would point out the fact that Jesus never once spoke about. Even though he's living in a slave society, he never speaks to that. And yet you have the apostles who do, and who you know, tell people how to treat their slaves and slaves how to react. And so they would say, and many churches prior to the war, even in the North, held that slavery was a biblical institution at the time. And certainly the South held to that. So they believed that slavery was something that went through the Bible and that it was there to bring Christianity to people who otherwise would not have it. That was their main argument.
Gordon, as you were planning about how you were going to dig through the archives to, or various archives, to find the materials that would be used in the book, did you have any sort of plan in mind, like, you know, I want to make sure I represent the average foot soldier as well as the general at the top of the chain, or I want to make sure that I include this perspective and that perspective, or did you just take what you find and then after that go through a process of prioritization?
Well, Tracy had an outline for what she wanted to write about in the book, and in her book she focuses on, she has a broad chapter on the historiography of this topic, and then she talks about the leadership, and then she talks about the elite ministers, and then going into the clergy, the chaplains, and the common soldiers. And so using that outline as a guide, you kind of know where you want to go in terms of finding the resources. And so, for example, I mentioned the Tennessee State Library and Archives. They have an enormous collection of information related to the common soldier and the soldiers in the field. And so you go about looking at letters and diaries and finding religious references in there. And for the elite ministers, for example, you would find a special collection like the one up in Suwannee at the University of the South that deals specifically with the Episcopal Church. And so there's a wide variety of resources that one can go to find information. A lot of people, novices, make the mistake that you can find what you need online, and certainly there's a lot of information online. But
most historians know when it comes to online, they have to separate the wheat from the chaff,
exactly. And so it really is important, particularly when you're talking about a scholarly work like this, to back up what you're saying with original records. And many of those aren't just aren't found online. You have to actually go to the archive and work with an archivist there, work with a librarian and special collections, and have them guide you to the resource.
And the book really is a book of primary sources, with the exception of the first chapter. And so really when we set out to write the book, we wanted it to be to let the soldiers tell the stories themselves, and as much as possible to step back and just use primary sources. And to me, those are the most fascinating sources that you can find anywhere. I mean, there's nothing like sitting down with a soldier's letter.
A first-person eyewitness account.
Right. And that's really what we wanted the book to be. It was just to let them tell their story and then to stand or fall by their own words, but to give them that opportunity to just tell their story.
Was MTSU of any help to you, either the Gore Center or the Center for Historic Preservation?
Absolutely. Specifically, the Center for Popular Music was really helpful. We have a few sections in the book that deal with the music and that was sung in the camps, and those types of things helped lift the spirits of this common soldier. And so the Center for Popular Music and their collections were very helpful in telling that story.
And Dr. Carol Van West, who just was a director in every sense. I mean, he was my thesis advisor, and Dr. Susan Meyer Shirk helped me with my thesis as well. But Dr. West just really put together and really got me focused, I think, in the beginning of this to help me set up an outline and get focused. And, you know, it's so easy to sort of just go everywhere because there's just so much information. And he was wonderful about getting me focused on where I needed to be and what my main goal was in doing this, and was just help beyond words.
One more brief break, and back with more on MTSU on the Record after this.
The Middle Tennessee State University Women's Studies Research Series features compelling monthly talks on gender-related topics by faculty and graduate students. The series offers a chance to learn about research in progress and to chat with faculty in an informal setting. All lectures are free and open to the public and are held on the MTSU campus. This is Associate Professor of Journalism, Dr. Jane Marcellus.
For all the latest MTSU information, go to mtsunews.com.
Continuing our discussion with Gordon T. Belt and Tracy Nichols Belt, the authors of Onward Southern Soldiers and both MTSU alumni, was the North aware of how the Confederacy was using religion to motivate the troops?
Yes. In fact, there's one quote that I have in the book where it says that someone went to Abraham Lincoln and said, the South are praying more than we are. And there, you know, that there was sort of this fear. And of course, both sides are very religious. It's an incredibly religious time period for America. And both sides, Abraham Lincoln makes probably one of the most famous quotes when he says that both sides read the same Bible and both pray to the same God. And they're both invoking the aid of God against the other. You know, there is this irony that's recognized, that they both see it as a religious war, and they both believe they have the righteous cause on their side. And it's very interesting in that sense, because you have people who just years before were going to conventions together, fellow Baptists fighting Baptists, and, you know, Methodists fighting Methodists. It's not like you have people of separate religions at war.
And now there are these terrible warring immigrants right. who are coming in.
Right, you know, they go from being brothers to believing the other side are basically infidels, and then after the war to becoming, in a lot of sense, brothers again. So it's a very unique time period.
So since the South lost the war, does that mean that even though we prayed more, we also sinned more?
It means that one of my soldiers, Private J.W. Harmon, sort of sums up what I think a lot of soldiers felt. At the end of the war, he writes, an all-wise providence saw fit that things should be changed. And he says, you know, we have bowed with reverence to his will. So there is this belief, most people believe sin was the downfall. Some believe that slavery, for example, was ordained of God, but that the South had failed to really bring it up to standards that God would have. And so God removed it. And they would say, it doesn't mean God didn't set it up to begin with, it just means God changed. Others would admit that we may have been wrong here, but that God only does what is right. But one of the things I found fascinating, they don't lose their faith at the end of the war. They explain it, and in many ways, the simple explanation is, God made this decision, and God doesn't do anything wrong, so we have to accept this. And they go on, and they serve God.
So since Lincoln took a very conciliatory attitude towards Southerners after the war was over, when some people wanted him to really kick the Southerners' butts mm-hmm. to pieces, he must have been reading more of his New Testament than his Old Testament.
He may have been more New Testament instead of Old Testament warrior.
If people want to get a copy of Onward Southern Soldiers, what do they need to do?
It's available pretty much on all the online, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, all those. It's in the stores. I know Barnes & Noble, we did a book signing here. You want to talk about the Posterity Project? They want an autographed copy.
Absolutely. I manage a blog called The Posterity Project at posterityproject.com. And on that blog, you'll find a link to where you can buy an autographed copy of the book.
And we have events.
We have events scheduled. You'll see a calendar of events on the blog.
Check your cyberspace listings. The book, once again, is called Onward Southern Soldiers, Religion and the Army of Tennessee in the Civil War, published by History Press and written by Tracy Nichols Belt and Gordon T. Belt. Thank you for making the trip all the way from Nashville down here to Murfreesboro just to do this show. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.